Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To reduce the Australian target to 19.
Bowl in, it's all over, and it is one of the most fantastic victories ever known in Test cricket history. Bob Willis, 8 wickets, a fabulous performance. England have won this match after one of the most astonishing fightbacks you could ever see.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, and that little bit of commentary there will just take you back to a wonderful day in the life of a man we've now lost, one of England's greatest cricketers, Bob Willis, of course. And it's a sad week, actually, because he was an iconic figure both on and off the field, Simon.
Well, magnificent bowler, fantastic bowler for England, 325 wickets, part of that. The old firm, really, if you like, of Boathman Willis, and there's a new firm now, although they're getting a bit older, Anderson and Broad. And then, of course, he made the transition after playing and being extremely successful as a player into the commentary box and into the television studio as well. And that's, of late, obviously, that's where he was really prominent. And, you know, the verdict with Bob Willis on Sky in the evening was required viewing, mainly because it was just funny just to see Bob just take people down. I mean,
unless you were the subject of his ire, of
course. Well, that's true. But I think he obviously cared about English cricket. That was the thing. Mm. And he sort of knew what he was doing. I mean, it was done in a knowing way. It must have been hard if you were the player or players who were being taken down. But it was cult viewing.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Well, we'll reflect on his life in a little bit. Also on this podcast, we're going to look ahead to England's tour of South Africa with the squad that has been announced, and also look at the crisis that is going on in South African cricket, which really has reached its nadir in the last few days. And we've got an interview with Neil Manthorpe, the very prominent South African journalist, talking about that whole issue. Bob Willis, I played against him a little bit, and actually, just looking at that footage of that amazing 8 for 43 at Headingley, it reminded me of two things about him, actually. One was this sort of amazingly rampaging run-up, you know, tearing down the hill from the Kirksall Lane end, no holds barred. And I always thought of him as being someone who had very open-chested action and you thought was very wide of the crease. This is a technical point. Actually, he was quite close to the stumps. And that made his short ball very hard to avoid, very direct, which is why he was so effective that day. The other thing about his run-up and his whole sort of demeanour, there was just a little noise before he let go of the ball. And that was, you might think it was a grunt or something, but actually it was the smack of his front foot. His front foot, you know, hit the ground really hard just before he let go of the ball. And that was all that impact of his run-up and his delivery and his huge kind of body action put into that one landing at the crease. And, you know, in a way you could see, A, why he was so consistently good because of that impact that he had, the anchoring of his front foot that enabled his body to propel that ball, and also why his knees were so ruined. Because, as I'm, you know, speaking from experience, the number of times you whack your foot down like that has a, you know, it sends shockwaves through your body and does make a real mess of your knees. And the fact that he was able to do that over 17,000 times for England in his career, which enabled him to take the 325 test wickets, was a phenomenal effort of resilience and determination, as well as the skill of getting the ball in the right place often enough.
How fast was he?
Fast, really fast. I mean, I think he's the greatest fast bowler of my and his generation. I mean, he's 10 years older than me, but that generation. Freddie Flintoff would have been as quick. Obviously, he was sort of, I see him as the next generation. Darren Goff as well. But from that era, he was head and shoulders, both in terms of height and speed, ahead of anybody else. He would be up there with, you know, if you look at the England's fastest bowlers that have ever lived that played consistently, Lyle would probably not quite as quick as Tyson. Tyson probably the quickest. Willis not far behind. Flintoff similar. Harmison occasionally that quick. So those men, I'd say, and obviously now we've got Jofra Archer, who I think is in that league. So we've probably had five. Truman, you know, people say, well, what about Fred Truman? Fred Truman had his moments when he was rapid, but I think Willis, with his height as well, had that extra ingredient.
Mm. And we talk about Botham's Ashes, but without Bob Willis at Headingley in 1981, nothing would have been possible. The remarkable last day of the match and that delivery when he got Ray Bright bowled middle stump, Willis sort of like whirring round and arms in the air, and then sort of sprinting off as well.
Yeah.
And it was almost as if he was in a daze. He bowled that spell in some sort of daze.
Or on drugs or something. I mean, he looked like a man possessed. And again, I think he got into the zone really effectively. He was able to, and you know, that's probably, we can come on to his punditry, but he got into the zone as a pundit as well, didn't he? And he had those sort of missions to explain something or you know, kind of criticise whatever it was. I think the other thing about him was he was just a total team man. And he would do anything for the team. And I'll give you a sort of quite funny story about that. I played against him a couple of times, as I said, and actually this came out, his devotion to the team, oddly came out with the bat. He wasn't a very good batsman. In fact, he was pretty hopeless. He was quite uncoordinated. But there was this one game I recall playing at Lord's, and it was late summer, and we'd had a lot of rain, and the pitch was really wet and sticky. It was drying, and it was turning square. It was turning the most I've ever seen a pitch turn. It was turning miles. If you look up the records, actually, 1981, Middlesex, Warwickshire, the 19 of the 20 Warwickshire wickets were taken by Embry and Edmonds, and the other wicket was a run out. I bowled three overs in each innings, I think, something like that, because the ball was turning so much. Bob Willis came in at number 8 to face Philip.
8?
Number 8. I know, yes. Your astonishment is justified. Number 8. I know. Came in at number 8. That doesn't say a lot for the people.
I know.
Lower
batting
down.
9, 10, 11.
Well, Dilip Doshi was number 11, who was an absolute rabbit. A couple of other people, obviously not too good. The ball was, as I say, turning from sort of leg. Philip Edmonds bowling left arm spin was turning leg to missing off. And the keeper was sort of taking it over his shoulder sort of thing outside the off stump. And we had two slips and a gully. Bob Willis had a bat that summer called a Run Reaper, which caused a bit of mirth just at the start, you know, seeing him come out. The Run Reaper was a bat made by Duncan Fernley, who in his wisdom decided to make a bat, or design a bat anyway, with lots of holes in it. Literally, lots of it was punctured. It looked like it had been strafed by a machine gun.
Really?
Yeah. And the idea of it was to help, in theory, aerodynamics. So you could swing it easier because of the wind that came through the holes, right? So it was lighter, technically. I don't know if that was ever proved, but that was the idea. And Bob Willis was the one guy kind of earmarked to try this bat out. in a way, it was never going to be a proof of whether it worked or not, because he didn't last long enough in an innings to really prove it. But particularly this innings was quite an interesting approach, because we were chuckling away seeing him come out at number eight with this run reaper bat with a batting average of about 12. What he did then was he took guard, as you do, with his bat side on, so sort of, you know, two legs or whatever it is, with your bat held with the edge pointing down the wicket to the umpire, took guard, and then continued to bat with his bat like that. And we looked at him and said, you know, Bob, there's a few men around the bat, so there was a bit of comment going on. It was, Bob, you got your bat, you know, haven't you batted before? You know, you're supposed to have your face, the bat facing down the pitch. No, no, he's going to face it with his edge. And he played with the edge of the bat. The theory being that he had less chance of edging the ball playing with just a, what effectively was a stump width blade.
Yeah.
It worked. We couldn't get him out. In both innings, he scored, I think, 11, but in about 45 minutes. Yeah. And so he played the line of the ball to Edmonds, and the ball would pitch leg stump and bounce viciously, and other people had been gloving it, and edging it to slip. Yeah. He kept missing it, and the wicketkeeper would be taking it over shoulder. And we couldn't get him out. And then when Edmonds bowled full at the stumps, tried to bowl a yorker, he brought the blade down with the edge front on and managed to keep it out. And it ball skewed off for runs. And, you know, our sort of laughter and you know, piss-taking kind of turned to sort of bewilderment and then actually frustration, because we couldn't get him out playing this way. And he did it just for the team. And he did it in both innings. And you know, we laughed at him, but he was absolutely deadpan. He kept on with it. And it sort of worked.
Bob Willis's first class average, 14.3, with two half centuries and a higher score of 72.
How he got an average of 14, God knows, really. I mean, he had a big reach, and he had a sort of uncomplicated swish outside off stump. But, yeah, that was about all.
And he played 128 test match innings, and his highest score was 28 not out.
But one of his, of course, one of his greatest test innings was the partnership with Ian Botham at Headingley of 37 for the last wicket in that great 81 test match, which got England that lead of 120-odd. Willis made two in that partnership, but it vitally kept the Aussies out there that bit longer, enabled Botham to get another 20-odd runs.
First memories of Bob, mine, were actually well before I was in the media, being a student in Birmingham and seeing Bob on the streets most mornings, actually, or quite regularly when he wasn't playing, you know, padding around the streets in his tracksuit, getting himself fit to bowl.
And which, I mean, obviously worked brilliantly for him. He'd had knee operations and things and had to do that to keep going. But his commitment to the cause and just, you know, the daily pain you suffer as a fast bowler, which, I mean, I had plenty of it, but him, you know, with that spindly body and that sort of huge physique and the pressure he put on his body every time he bowled with that great long run-up. And everyone called him Goose, of course, because he looked like a goose trying to take off when he was running to the wicket. Everybody mimicked him. Gooch, I remember Graham Gooch, was one of the first who was very good at mimicking Bob Willis's action. I think Mark Ramprakash's impression was as good as anybody's, actually.
Alistair Cook did one as well.
Yeah, and he got a wicket, didn't he?
Yeah, I was there at Trent Bridge against India. Yeah, his only test wicket.
And it shows, that's an interesting point, because in a way, Alistair Cook was born just after Willis retired, 1984. So it shows how Willis's legacy continued, even though people hadn't grown up with him. His reputation, you know, went beyond even his own generation to the next generation of people who were familiar with him, even though they never saw him play or anything.
Yeah. What about sort of Bob's transformation from player to commentator, pundit? Actually, because when he was playing, I remember interviews with him that were quite, you know, he didn't like the criticism, did he, that was around at the time for England players. And he wasn't the most fluent in interviews. They were his answers were quite short. There was an interview he gave Peter West, didn't he, at Headingley, which was, you know, in a way quite grudging.
Well, he had a go at the press, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I think as a pundit, what he was brilliant at was in a way almost voicing what the man in the street thought. You know, rather than making excuses for players and seeing it from the player's point of view, I think he saw it from the public's point of view and made mostly valid criticisms. At times, they're a bit too vehement, I suppose. But there was always, even though he had that sort of rather monotone delivery and not very expressive, I think there was always just a little, tiny little bit of humour behind it.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. Don't you think? That sort of turn to the camera, that sort of lugubrious manner. He was just gradually, ever so subtly, with that voice of his, dismantling England's latest performance. Let's listen to a bit of Bob on the verdict when England were bounced out by India on the final day at Lord's in 2014.
Think of all the horror movies you can, Charles. Nightmare on Elm Street, very Rocky Horror Show, Dracula, Frankenstein's Monster. This was unbelievable. I've seen fewer hookers in Soho on a Saturday night than I saw at Lord's this afternoon. And the dunce's cap was going around the England dressing room quicker than past the parcel. No sooner was it on Matt Pryor's ball pate that it was whipped off by the ginger nut Stokes and then quickly settled on the cherubic noggin of Joe Root. So it was an absolute shambles.
Of course, you don't want to be the subject of his ire, do you? And I'm sure there have been plenty of players who felt really aggrieved at the kind of things that Willis said. No holes barred. I mean, in a way, he was a pundit like he was a bowler. You know, very direct, quite aggressive, sort of hostile, but passionate. And the game at the heart was the thing that he cared about the most. And so even if he was unwavering, unyielding, at times uncompromising with his punditry, it was because he cared, ultimately, and he wanted England to do well.
He didn't play as much for Warwickshire as the Warwickshire members and Warwickshire support would have liked. There was a feeling that he saved himself a bit for England.
Yeah, I think it was inevitable. I mean, if you think about 325 test wickets, and he had to play for Warwickshire as well. Look at the state of players like Anderson and Broad now, who are able to carry on probably potentially longer.
Central contracts.
Because of central contracts, and they don't have to. They barely play for their counties. I mean, certainly Anderson barely plays for Lancashire. Obviously, there is more sort of training and drills and preparation required for a test player now than in Bob Willis's day. But to be able to play for your county as well as your country as a fast bowler was tough. So inevitably, he did rein back a little bit at county level. There was this one classic story which people often tell about him when he was playing for Warwickshire. He had no ball trouble. He often used to overstep the line, which is another reason I sort of sympathise with him, because I did as well. And anyway, so he was bowling one day at Edgbaston and he was overstepping constantly and not having a huge amount of success that particular day. And after about the 15th no ball, he was walking back to his mark and some chap in the Eric Hollies stand, some local man, was sort of, "Boy, Willis, why can't you keep your foot behind the line, Willis?" Like this. And Willis just stared across towards the Hollies stand and just said, "Why don't you bleep off and build a car?" And I mean, everybody just fell about laughing, but he was absolutely steadfast in walking back to his mark and running in again.
I think it was the deadpan humour that worked so well in his punditry, actually. Again, it was just that knowing look that you knew exactly what he was doing. I'll miss him on the verdict.
Oh,
really?
Yes.
Well,
yeah. I mean, he'd be a huge loss. His contribution to England was immense. And his contribution to the world of TV sport also was immense. It's fantastic to have two so successful careers. And I think that, in a way, he gave a lot of us as commentators the confidence to speak our minds. He was brave in what he said. And we, you know, quite often others of us, or people working with him, sort of hid behind him. Yeah. But he was very forthright, and he made that programme a compelling watch. Yeah. And he's been rudely denied living into old age, because 70 is far too young for a man of that stature and skill and passion to be to be removed from us.
Yeah, and that's a very good point, actually, about that idea of sort of hiding behind him, because it was all that sort of idea of, oh, yeah, get Bob in, wind him up, let him go, and then and everybody else doesn't have to sort of get involved in all that. And you I'm sure you must be conscious that the players are watching in the evening. You get back to your hotel room, you get your remote control out, you turn on the TV, there's the verdict on Sky Sports. I don't know whether players do that or whether they shun media completely after a bad day, but there must be that temptation, and there's Bob in full sail, taking it on and bouncing players out, basically.
Yeah, a really, really sad week. And for me, sort of part of my childhood's gone there because I grew up watching him.
Right, England have named their squad for their tour of South Africa. A quick turnaround, barely back from New Zealand, barely a chance to get over the jet lag, and off to South Africa at the end of the week.
By the way, I notice you've got the trousers on now, so you have actually finally given up the shorts, and you'll have to stick with that for a while now.
It is December. Back from New Zealand, and quick turnaround, straight off to South Africa. Squad announced at the weekend. Jimmy Anderson back in the squad, Mark Wood, Johnny Bairstow back in the squad. They took Mahmood and Parkinson to South Africa, and Sibley and Crawley. And both those two stay, the two batsmen. But Taki Mahmood has gone already, but barely played on the tour. He played in the T20 matches, a few of the T20 matches. Didn't play much of a part in the Red Bull part of the tour. And Parkinson, ditto. But he stays in. Moeen Ali stays out. 2 years out from the Ashes, a year out from India. I do worry for England overseas, not so much in South Africa, although I think there's a lot of expectation that they're going to go there and win. And I don't know, they have had good times in South Africa. It seems to suit their game for some reason. South Africa are on a low at the moment, as we'll discuss in a moment. But I don't know whether there's a bit too much expectation about this England side. They're fallible. They've still got problems at the top of the order. The bowlers are struggling to take wickets overseas with the Kookaburra ball. What about the spin attack? They didn't play a spinner in their last test match. Is that sustainable into the future? You'll need a good spinner in Australia. You'll definitely need spinners in Sri Lanka and two or three next winter in India. It seems as if they're attempting to solve some of the problems, certainly at the top of the order, but there are no obvious solutions at the moment. They just seem to be a team that is reasonably well set up to win at home, but away from home, it's hard. I think it's hard to see fortunes turning.
I think they probably will win in South Africa for reasons that we'll come on to in a minute, but I agree with you about the sort of future planning, and I think it feels like a team that constantly gets sort of patched up and sent out again, and rather than this plan for, if we just think about India and Australia, the two big tours to come the next 2 years, you need definitely in India some good spinners. And I don't see Jack Leach really being the answer, although I'm sure he'll do a perfectly acceptable job. But you need someone with a bit more wicket-taking ability. And in Australia, they're going to need tall, fast bowlers, not... I can't see Anderson and Broad taking wickets in Australia in 2 years' time, even if they are still fit. I don't think they've got the skills to take the wickets now in drop-in pitches with the Kookaburra ball in Australia. So I worry about that. I want to see somebody new coming through. Who that is, it's difficult to identify.
Isn't that the problem?
I would have given Saki Mahmood a go in New Zealand, see how he went. I think it's nothing to lose. They'd lost the first test, or maybe they should have given him a go in the first test. Anyway, I would have taken him on this tour to South Africa and tried to blood him there.
Yeah, well, they've gone back to bowlers they're familiar with. I mean,
Mark Wood is a potentially good. But I see, again, I'm not sure that Mark Wood will take wickets in Australia either, because he's too short. You look at Australia's fast attack: Mitchell Starc, Josh Hazlewood, Pat Cummins. They're all 6'3" and higher, and they all bowl 88 to 92 miles an hour. I can't see bowlers of the little seamers. I'm sorry to say, Anderson is a little seamer. He's not little. He's not really a seamer, I suppose. He's a swinger. But I can't see bowlers like that taking wickets there now. Their pitches have changed from, you know, 2010-11, England won in Australia brilliantly with Tim Bresnan and Anderson, obviously. Chris Tremlett played a role in that as well. But those pitches are different from now. They were nibbly pitches. They're not anymore.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's not easy to see England's a smooth path for England to the Ashes. They've sort of stated that's their goal, to win back the Ashes in 2 years' time. At the moment, it's not obvious how they're going to better do it with the personnel that they've got. You almost sort of sense that they are, you know, you've got to take the series that's in front of you. Of course you have. South Africa first and then Sri Lanka, completely different challenges. But you also have to have what's a clear plan as well. And it's all very well to say there's the plan to win in Australia in 2 years' time, but it's not obvious that where the personnel is to do that. And perhaps they're just hoping that as time goes on, someone will emerge. I mean, that's not a great plan. I know they're working with, you know, they have spin bowling camps, don't they? And they have pace bowling camps, and they're working with some of the younger spinners.
And the Lions are on tour.
Exactly.
So.
And they're working with the, you know.
They are trying to find people.
Exactly. But if the system is not producing them, then what can you do? In a way, I suppose you do have to go back to the tried and tested and hope it will work. But our memories are of England having really difficult times in India and Australia. I mean, they are such difficult places to conquer now, especially with the personnel that England have.
So England go to South Africa shortly, and the first test is the 26th of December at Centurion, unusually, because it's normally Durban, isn't it, that first test. Where England do have a great advantage is that South African cricket is in total crisis. I've never seen before a situation like this in any international team, actually, where the board are totally discredited, where everybody wants the board removed, where the debts are massive. There's no selection committee or director of cricket.
Well, we don't even know who's selecting the side.
Exactly. So I feel a bit sorry for Faf du Plessis. And I feel sorry for a lot of the South African cricketers, actually, because they're in the middle of playing in their T20 tournament, the Umzansi Super League. And to all reports, and the odd thing that I've seen of it as well, it's actually quite a good tournament. There's some quite really good cricket played, and the players are absolutely giving it their all. But it hasn't been very well marketed, there's hardly anybody watching it, and it's in massive debt, as is South African cricket generally. It's reached an absolutely peak stage now, where the chief executive of Cricket South Africa is a guy called Thabang Moro. He's been in charge for a year and a half. He has caused all sorts of unrest with the players' union and with just generally the public. A lot of journalists have been calling for him to be removed or to resign. It culminated in five journalists having their accreditation removed because they were critical of him and his board. It's a classic case of megalomania, of someone just sort of running the roost himself without much consultation with anybody else, to the extent where, I'll give you an example of this, one of the disputes going on has been the players who haven't been paid for some work they did on last year's Umzansi Super League. They're owed quite a lot of money for their commitment to various promotions. And when they complained about it, three people were suspended from the board: Corrie Van Sale and Clive Eckstein, who are sort of director of cricket and marketing, and the chairman and the chief selector as well. They were sacked for supposed dereliction of duty, in other words, not satisfying these payments to the players. And it turned out the only person who had signature rights on the cheques was Thabang Moro, the chief executive. So everything points back to him, and now he has been suspended pending sort of further investigation. One of the guys who's been really on this case throughout has been Neil Manthorpe, the very well-known broadcaster and writer on South African cricket. So I talked to him about his take on it all.
The board, the CSA appointees, are just catatonic. They can't believe that this is all going to go wrong for them. I mean, they've been carefully planning this with Nenzani and Moro for years, and now their whiskers are in the cream, and suddenly it's all going wrong, and they just can't face it. Thabang Moro and the president both need to step down. Graham Smith is is prepared to take the job on, he would be a really good director of cricket. He needs to be appointed. He then needs to appoint a coaching team and just get the confidence back of the players. And if they made appointments like that, that it would be an almost instant restoration of confidence and sponsors would come back. But they've just been gradually, one by one, not renewing their contracts, not renewing their deals. I mean, there's none of the domestic competitions are sponsored. You know, it's the CSA four-day competition, the CSA one-day competition, it's the CSA provincial competition. There's no sponsors, none of them. I mean, that's why we're heading towards a billion rand debt and bankruptcy within 2 years.
So that was Neil Manthorpe. It's reached ahead this weekend with a special meeting and a presentation at which, as I say, Tabang Moreau was suspended. They've brought in another individual, Jack Fole, as their temporary chief executive, while they try and find a permanent person. And also, they've announced that there's a very strong likelihood that Graham Smith will take over as director of cricket, and that is much needed because they've got 2 weeks to prepare for the England tour.
Well, it sounds as if they're beginning to get themselves sorted out, but whether you can do that in such a short space of time remains to be seen. As you mentioned, they've still got a lot of very talented cricketers, albeit that, you know, there is a bit of a player drain as well, and they've lost players. I did an interview with Tatenda Taibu in the summer. He was promoting his new book, and he was talking about Zimbabwean cricket. And one thing he said in the interview, which really struck me at the time, he said, "What happened in Zimbabwe cricket could happen in South African cricket." And what I thought of that, actually, that interview, when I heard about the problems in the last few weeks that South African cricket has faced. Normally, South African series, England, South Africa, either home or away, is compelling viewing, actually. It's great to be there and watch it. The weather is normally fantastic. The pitches are quite good. The crowds are good as well. Lots of England supporters go to watch. It creates a good atmosphere. It's normally an excellent series. I hope it's the same. But there's still, I mean, there's some quality there. I mean, England, well, they will not go there complacent. Of course they will. No. They can't be complacent.
I mean, there's some quality bowling. Mm. I'm not sure about the batting.
Well, they've got Dean Elgar, they've got Du Plessis.
Yeah, but they haven't got a lot. I mean, Aidan Markham's a good player, yeah. But there's not that much. You know, lost Hashim Amla, yeah, to retirement recently. AB de Villiers, yeah, before that.
It's not the formidable size.
No Dale Steyn, no, either. He's retired. No. So, you know, they've lost three. Mornie Morkel's now a, yeah, Colpack playing for Surrey. So, you know, they're not the team they were 5 years ago. And actually, if you look at their record, I mean, this year, they've lost all the test matches they've, yeah, played. They lost two test matches to Sri Lanka at home. And that's the first time they've lost a series to an Asian team at home ever.
Yeah. And, of course, they got well beaten in India as well. Mind you, there'll be a few teams that will happen to, and there's the team that's heading to South Africa, I think, will be well beaten in India,
yeah, next year. I mean, you know, from a practical point of view, South Africa, they, having lost all these test matches this year, they've also got no real time to prepare for the England series because, as I say, they've been playing in the T20 league. Yeah. They've got one round of red ball cricket, provincial first-class cricket, and then straight into the test series.
Yeah, we'll see. They're tough though, aren't they?
They are tough, and they've got their own conditions.
And also, in a way that if they're underdogs, they'll have a cause to fight for. And England, they've clearly got some quality in their side, you know, Root and Stokes and Archer, etc. But they're also vulnerable as well. And there's no real indication in New Zealand that they've solved some of the problems that have beset them over the last few years. It'll be a fascinating series, actually. And I don't think it will be as straightforward for England as some people are suggesting. I get the feeling that most people expect England to go to Africa and win. But who knows?
Yeah, I agree. It's uncertain, partly because England are just a fragile team who haven't got much backbone with the batting at the top of the order yet. Mm. I think it's gradually coming together, but still there are holes there. And have they got the bowling attack to take wickets on flat pitches? At least it's augmented by the experience of Anderson and Broad and the pace of Wood. So it looks a better attack than they had in New Zealand. But they're going to probably have to work hard because the batting order might not make enough runs.
Hmm. Well, if people get fit. Mark Wood's not going to be fit at the start, is he? They reckon he'll be fit as the series goes on. That's the hope, anyway. Jimmy Anderson, we don't know, big question mark. He hasn't bowled for months and months and months. there are lots of question marks against England's lineup as well as South Africa's lineup.
Yeah, and I just hope actually that South Africa get it together because we need them.
Absolutely.
As a very important cog in the whole kind of machine of international cricket. They had a poor World Cup. They've been losing a lot of players to other countries. They still have an amazing number of coaches around the world who are very successful. But the playing, they need to play well to convince everybody that they're worth watching.
Well, it all starts on Boxing Day. England got a couple of warm-up games before then, one first-class match and one two-day game. So not much preparation time. And then straight on to Boxing Day and Centurion. Let's hit the thunderstorms. Stay away. It's a feature of going to that ground. The thunderstorms build up in the evening. No Durban Test match this time. Four games and then three T20s and three one-day internationals. Actually, and the one-day internationals that come up actually before the T20s, first time that England will have played a one-day international since the World Cup final.
So that's it for this week. Don't forget the special offer on the Cricketer magazine, Christmas issue, thecricketer.com/Christmas. Very, very good offer with a £20 John Lewis voucher or a signed copy of Alistair Cook's autobiography, which could be a useful Christmas present for someone. Have a good week. We'll speak to you next time.
Goodbye for now.
Podcast Network.